And that doesn't celebrate the birth of the Jewish people at all. When would that be? Would be a difficult question. It celebrates the birthday of the world, the birthday of the creation, Rosh Hashanah, and the new year. And they blow the ram's horn or shofar, which is, if it's done correctly, is a very powerful thing. That's kind of to awaken the soul from its sleep. Let me see if I can get that. Is it working? No. Oh, what? one of them, a man and woman, are both created in the image of God, in the image, in our image, we created them, plural, and then another woman is created from a rib of Adam. Marcia doesn't like that one as well. And then there's the Garden of Eden, sort of a primordial paradise, and you can look at that as man living in complete harmony with nature. We once heard a conference, a Chumash Indian chief saying that before you white men came, we Indians lived in Eden, Garden of Eden. Our way of life was in harmony with nature. In any event, they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, this was forbidden, and entered into the world of conflict and opposites, good versus evil. And all. I talked about that a little in the Taoist class, because this is a poem about before the conflict of good and evil, and then the conflict of good and evil. And then there's a story of Noah and the flood, and where mankind had become so wicked that God destroyed all mankind with a flood, and except for Noah and his family. Curiously, there's a story identical to that in a book called The Gilgamesh. How many of you have heard of The Gilgamesh? Gilgamesh is the oldest book of Western civilization, going back to ancient Mesopotamia. And it has a story very much like Noah and the flood, almost identical, except the Noah in that story is named Utnapishtim. And anyway, so there was a story back then. So we're at the Noah and the flood, and then the rainbow covenant after the flood is over, that God will never destroy the world with a water again, but it doesn't say he won't destroy it with fire, so it's not completely off the hook there. Then the son of Noah and his wife, Shem, has a series of descendants, and the major figure again, you take up with again, is Abraham, who becomes renamed Abraham, and he is he's not in Israel, he's in Mesopotamia, or which means between the two rivers, and that's present-day Iraq. It's also called the Sumeria and Babylonia, Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That was the probably the earliest center of high Western civilization. And he was commanded by God, El Shaddai at the time, to leave his father's house and his kindred and go forth to Canaan, which was the promised land. And Abraham and his people then were probably Semitic peoples, and they were called Hebrews, and they made the journey out of the high civilization of the time, Mesopotamia, which was polytheistic culture. They had many gods and goddesses representing each a different force of nature, the sky god, the sun god, the god of war, god of the underworld, god of love, and so on, follow this is the beginning of the concept of monotheism, one God. But it's not really developed highly until we get to Moses. El Shaddai really means a God of the mountain. It's associated with Mount Horeb, Sinai, which is probably the same mountain in the the Judean desert. Anyway, he comes to Canaan, Abraham, and he receives initiation by, and no one explains exactly what this means, by the Melchizedek, the high priest of Salem, or high priest of Jerusalem, which means city of peace, Jerusalem, city of peace. Salem means peace or shalom. And his wife and he are quite old by then, something like 190, and his wife hasn't born any child yet, and he has a child with her handmaid, Hagar, Ishmael, and that comes in later in the Islam story, because that he becomes the father of the Arab peoples. But God promises a son, and they have a son, Isaac, in old age. And Isaac is these are the great patriarchs of Judaism, Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. And Jacob had a very significant experience out in the desert or whatever one day, where he slept and had a dream of a kind of a ladder in which angels descended up and down from heaven to earth, up and down. And then when he woke up, he said, God has been in this place, and I didn't even know it. So in any event, when he had that, he had a later experience of wrestling all night with an angel of God, and he dislocated his hip, and God renamed him from Jacob to Israel, Yisrael, which means he who struggles with God. So Israel is not actually, literally, it is not, but it was not then the name of a land, it was the name of a man, Jacob, who was renamed Israel. Did you all know that? Oh, anyway, he's renamed Israel, and his descendants are the Israelites, and he has 12, anytime you want to raise questions, he has 12 sons, and he has a favorite son, Joseph, and he gives Joseph a, you know this from Sunday school, a coat of, or cloak of many colors, and the other sons are jealous of this, and they throw him in a pit to die, and then later they feel guilty, and they come back and take him out of the pit and sell him to some slave traders. And eventually, he's in Egyptian prison. Egypt is another high civilization of the time. See? And the Jewish people left the Mesopotamia to come to Canaan, and later, you'll see, they leave Egypt. Anyway, Joseph has a gift of dream interpretation. He's kind of an early Freud or Jung. And Pharaoh had a dream he couldn't understand of seven lean cows and seven fat cows. And one of his people told the Pharaoh that there's a man here in prison who has a gift of dream interpretation. So he said, bring him to me. And he did, and he interpreted that as seven fat years, or 7 years of plenty, would be followed by 7 years of famine. So he followed that, and during the 7 years of plenty, stored lots of grains and unperishable foods and all, so they could survive the seven lean years or famine. So they did. So that's Joseph. And there's a famine out there, and Jacob, old man by now, and the 11 other sons and their families know that there's a lot of food was stored in Egypt, so they come there, and Joseph recognizes them, doesn't tell them right away who he is, later tells them who he is. You know. Anyway, the Pharaoh of that time then welcomed these Israelites, they were called Israelites now, to Egypt, and they settled there, and they became prosperous, and they multiplied, and everything. And considered to be, and by the way, the dates of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is about 1800 or 19th century BC or 1800s BC, and the dates of, we're talking about, when we get up to Moses, is around the 1200s BC. Yes?
Does anybody need these lights on? Do you need them on?
Lower. Well, I'd like to see them in my notes.
That's okay. I just...
But is there a way to lessen the lights? Yeah, that's
okay.
No, that's great.
Okay, do that. Yeah. Fine. That's good. And you can turn these off, maybe, if you want.
I think that would turn those off.
Oh, okay. All right, so Ramses said that the Israelites have become so numerous, they're kind of going to overwhelm us. So he decreed something very mean and said that all of the newborn children, may have been the newborn males, I'm not sure, will be slain. And they were, but the mother of Moses, who's a Hebrew, Moshe is his name, put him in a little basket, like an ark, a little basket, and trusted in God and floated him down the river. And then one of the daughters of Pharaoh, Ramses II, saw this and thought that one of her gods had sent a child to her. She apparently was childless or whatever. And then they raised Moses as a Egyptian prince. And you all know that if you saw the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston, did that the best. Anyway, so he was raised an Egyptian prince and, learned everything there was in the high Egyptian civilization, which had the high architecture, science of the time, mathematics, astronomy, and had polytheistic religion. It also had a period of Aton religion and worship of the sun, which, I won't get ahead of myself into Freud, that will be next week, but postpone that. In any event, at the age, scholars figured out at about the age of 40, Moses went out and somehow he knew that he was a Hebrew. I don't know how he knew. But he saw one of the Israelites being severely beaten by one of the Egyptian taskmasters. The Israelites built the pyramids and great cities, and they worked under terrible slavery. They were enslaved. He saw the Israelite beaten. He struck and killed the Egyptian, and then he knew he'd be in trouble. So he escaped off into the desert and the land into Midian, the land of the Midianites. And then in reality, and also in the movie The Ten Commandments, he rescued seven daughters of Jethro from some shepherds who were ready to perhaps rape them or physically abuse them. He easily defeated them. And later, Jethro gave his oldest daughter, Zipporah, to marry. And they had a son. I forget what is the son's name? You read the Bible three times. Okay, anyway. So he has a son. Look at my notes. Gershom. His son is Gershom. And his son's name, Gershom. Many of the names in the Bible, or all the names in the Bible, have symbolic meanings. And Gershom means a stranger. So he was a stranger in this land. So The tradition considers Jethro as a holy teacher who taught Moses. He was not a Hebrew, but he was a Midianite, and they worshipped the same God, one God, so he was initiated into the monotheistic religion of one God by Jethro, who was his father-in-law and his teacher. And then one day, while tending sheep, he was a shepherd, he saw up on Mount Horeb something that got his attention. It was a bush, it was a thorn bush that was burning, but though it burned a long time, it wasn't consumed, it kept burning. So he climbed up there to that bush, and that's my favorite story in the Bible. Let me read it from the Bible, from Exodus 14. Exodus 4. Okay. Exodus 3, 4. Okay. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And that's probably Sinai. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame out of fire. Appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, and yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him, and out of the bush said, Moses, Moses. And Moses answered in ancient Hebrew, Heneni, here am I, Heneni. Then he said from the bush, do not come near, put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Anyway, the Jewish religion, Moses is always considered the highest prophet, the one who confronted God face to face. Says he doesn't really look at him directly. And so he reveals himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says that he, Moses, is going to lead his people, the Israelites, out of bondage in Egypt to the promised land. And Moses said in Hebrew, Mi Anochi, which means, who am I? It means, who am I? We're just at the burning bush, and Moses is say your name again?
Mark.
Oh, yeah, Mark. Okay, Moses is confronted by God in the burning bush and says, Me, Anoki, who am I? Who am I to lead the children of Israel out of... he's not very confident that he can do this. So, Yahweh, or God, answers, Ki, is the Hebrew Bible, Ki Ahia Imcha, Ki Ahia Imcha, I am with you, I am with you. So if you're in a situation like that, and God says, I am with you, that should kind of greatly increase your self-confidence. So Moses was reluctant to take on this task. And in my book, I talk a lot about this, an allegorical or psychological levels that relate to that. Because, talking about slavery, the slave, to be enslaved, you have to deprive people of their identity. By the way you talk to them, by the way you treat them, they were treated like beasts of burden. So they kind of gave up and became, instead of their own selves, they became who Pharaoh and the Egyptians said they were. You are who we say you are, rather than you are who you are. So, now, a momentous moment when God asks the name, I mean, not God, but Moses asks the name of God. This is from Exodus 3:13. Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, give you the Hebrew first, Ehiya Asher Ehiya, is generally translated, "I am that I am," or in this translation, "I am who I am." I am who I am. And that's kind of a great theological mystery. God does not define himself beyond that. And then he goes on to say, and he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. Okay? So, God reveals himself as the first person of the verb to be. I am. You can... That's a very different kind of God than, say, the God of the ancient Greeks at that time, who had a polytheistic system. They had 12 major gods, and the major father god figure was Zeus, and the mother god figure Hera, and these are gods. Sort of personified human beings of great, expanded to great power, and this is, and then there's a total of 12 gods in the Greek polytheism. There was another polytheism that had 33 gods. I don't remember offhand which one that was. The polytheism of the time of Muhammad, he brought the kind of monotheism to the Arab peoples. There were something like 360 gods, but a multiplicity. So it was polytheistic cultures in which the ancient Hebrews, later to be known as Israelites, and then much later Jews, discovered, made the discovery of the one God. And in the Western traditions, you have what's called systematic theology. I don't know what that is, but many theologians or teachers with various kind of theories of God, but God reveals himself very simply as I am that I am, and there's no further comment necessary. And that would be, in Judaism, the highest name of God, and they wouldn't even pronounce that. Instead of saying that, they call God Ad Oshem, which means the name. They won't even say that name. They'll say Ad Oshem, which means the name, and behind that is the name revealed to Moses. So, so Moses is himself strengthened in his confidence by this awesome experience of of God at the burning bush. Euston Smith goes on to say, this is the theologian who wrote the Religions of Man, when it's renamed World Religions. He says, science makes major contributions to minor needs, but religion, however small its successes, is at least at work on the things that matter most. And here, when a lone spirit succeeds in breaking through to major conquests here, it becomes more, the lone spirit, like a king or queen. It becomes a world redeemer. Its impact stretches for millennia, blessing the tangled course of history for centuries. And then I read that, who are the greatest benefactors of mankind? Confucius, Lao Tzu, Buddha, the prophets of history. So that experience of Moses was so awesome that it really gave birth to the Jewish religion, to Judaism, which was the mother religion of Christianity and Islam later. So that's, and they are all monotheistic religions. Our pastor, Pastor Joseph, what's his name, Joseph Smith, said in one of his sermons, you won't find the Trinity in the Bible. You don't really find that in the Bible. You find God is one is in the Bible. I don't know how, well, there's a whole history of Christianity there after the biblical times. But so then Moses is strengthened by this, and he joins his brother Aaron, and he's a better speaker. Sometimes Aaron speaks for Moses, but Moses is a stutterer, and sometimes Moses speaks, but he immediately goes down to Egypt and asks Pharaoh to let my people go, because the Lord has commanded that. And the Pharaoh says, I don't know the Lord. Who are you talking about? We have our gods. And then he set harder burdens on the people of Israel, the Israelites, and even deprived them of straw to make bricks, so they had to gather stubble or something to make bricks for their building. And should I talk about the four-level theory? Okay. In my book, I developed kind of a four-level theory. And there was a level of slavery where the Israelites simply complied with what they were told to do. You know, it's kind of a harsh punishment for not doing so, like death and so on. But they could have rebelled. And later, Moses gets angry and slays and kills the Egyptian. And then later, there's a series of pleadings why Pharaoh should free the people of Israel, and I call that self-justification. So there's compliance, angry rebellion, then trying to justify freedom, and then there's a series of plagues that Yahweh, later by the way, God reveals after the I am that I am, the name Yahweh, which means he causes to be. He causes to be, or causes to be, I don't know if there's a he in there, but causes to be. So the series of plagues from blood, the Nile is made blood, all the way in frogs and other kinds of pestilence, and you can see them as somewhat of a natural development if you want. And then Moses always carried a staff like this. At one point he threw down the staff and it changed into a snake, and then the Egyptian magicians also did the same thing, but the Israelite snake ate all of the other snakes, and that was kind of a bad sign for the Egyptians. So it comes all the way down to the slaying of the firstborn. And that's the where the Passover comes in. The angel of God told the Israelites to slay sheep, lambs, I should say, lambs, same thing, and spread their blood over the doorway of every Israelite house. So when God sent the angel of death, he has an angel of death too, the angel of death did not strike the firstborn where there was blood of the lamb up there, but passed over that. And so that's where the holiday of Passover comes from. Passover, Pesach, Passover. And that is a commemoration for Jewish people of the story of the liberation of the Israelites from bondage in Egypt to the Promised Land. And comes from the angel of death passing over the houses of the Israelites. And then the firstborn of Egypt were all struck dead. And there's a parallel in, let me go back and give you some, I obviously don't have time to, in this 1 hour, to give you the whole Jesus story, but I'll make allusions to that. I forgot an allusion God, as you saw, revealed himself in Exodus as I am that I am. And there's a very powerful statement of Jesus somewhere in the Gospel according to John, where he's challenged by the Pharisees when he kind of claims some authority, like Abraham said, how can you, a man less than 50, say things like this about our father Abraham? And Jesus answered very confidently, before Abraham even was, I am. So that in the Gospel, according to John, there are a series of I am statements connected with Jesus. There's kind of a, and then with the Passover and the blood of the Lamb, in Christianity, Jesus is seen as a sacrificial lamb, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Comment on that? So, and then the Passover, which later became in Judaism, the Seder, somewhere usually in April around the Easter time, where this is enacted in your home, in homes, with a Passover Seder plate and all. Generally, most Christians and theologians, except for a few who kind of always disagree with everything, like Paul Hansen and Harvard, consider the consider the Last Supper to have been a Passover Seder. And the Passover Seder, there is a bread and wine. Unleavened bread is a matzah, because they didn't have time to use yeast to leaven the bread. And the wine, this rituals of eating bread or matzah and wine, and many times during the Passover Seder. And that's where Jesus, who was a Jewish rabbi, mostly addressed as rabbi, says that I am the bread and I am the wine, and institutes the Holy Communion. So there are parallels there. So where are we? We are at the slaying of the firstborn of Egypt, and then the Pharaoh says, take all of your Israelites and you can go. So Moses and Aaron and Joshua gathered up about 600,000 people or so, and families and sheep and whatever, cows, and they all march out of Egyptian bondage and come to the Red Sea. Some call it the Reed Sea, let's call it the Red Sea, and that's a body of water that is they have to cross. But Pharaoh, Ramses II, changes his mind. His heart becomes hardened and says, what did I do that for? So he sends his armies and chariots after the Israelites, go and take them back, and or slay them, who won't come back. And so this is a, this may be where the expression between the devil and the deep blue sea came, I don't know. But the hundreds of thousands of Israelites are now trapped there at the bank of the Red Sea, with the sea in front of them, and the armies of the Pharaoh coming to re-enslave them or kill them. And they get real mad at Moses. What did you do this to us for? We were better off alive slaves than dead heroes or martyrs. So Moses said, don't worry about it. Watch this. See the salvation of the Lord. And then he doesn't even know what to do. So he has an inner dialogue with God, and God said, just so God said, stretch out your staff over the sea, and it will part. So he does that, and then a east wind blows all night long, and eventually becomes dry land, and the Israelites can walk and ride their oxen and whatever, and sheep and everything, across the sea, and then they're all on the other side. But the Egyptian armies and chariots are still coming, and they say, we're in trouble now anyway. So he said, don't worry about that. See the salvation of the Lord. So he asked God what to do again. He said, well, rise up your staff again, and the sea will close over the Egyptians. So it did, and they were all drowned, and then they're free, but they're not yet in the promised land. And now all these events, by the way, I'll mention, are not just literal. They have four levels of interpretation in Judaism. Judaism it is not like a fundamentalist Christianity, which likes literal interpretation. There's a literal level, but there's also a allegorical level. What does this mean, sort of allegorically? And there's a, and you can get that by getting this book, Physicians of the Soul. And then there's a metaphysical level, metaphysical, that's talked about in the Kabbalah. And then there's a mystical level. Mystical level, and it's experiencing those things in yourself. So you can see some sort of personal parallels to your own experience of finding a kind of selfhood or identity again through an experience of God, of having courage to break free of. Finally, by the way, that's the fourth level, is just not conforming or rebelling violently or self-justifying, but just going ahead and being free, and going, and they did that, and they have to exercise faith to do that, and no one ever could say what faith is, but there is something like that that works, faith in an unseen God. So anyway, they're across the sea, and the man of faith here was Moses, really, and later Jesus was a man of faith. He said, if he had as much faith as a grain of mustard seed, and said to a mountain, move from here to there, it would be so. So that's the kind of faith that Moses showed when he raised his staff and the Red Sea parted. So then they have a 40-year journey in the Sinai desert. If they had gone the direct route, it was only 50 miles, by the way, they could have gotten there in a few days, but they made a very circuitous route. And what happened in that time was most of the people who were enslaved eventually died, and this was a new generation mostly who went into the Promised Land, although Joshua may have been around the beginning, and he was, but a little later, before they go into the Promised Land, fairly soon after they've left the Egypt across the Red Sea, there's another revelation of God on Mount Sinai, it's called now, and that's the Ten Commandments. And Moses, it seems like a volcanic mountain, there's fire and smoke and rumbling and everything. And Moses, God tells Moses, don't let the people come up here because it's too dangerous. But Moses goes up there, and he spends 40 days up there, like Jesus spent 40 days on the in the desert, another parallel. And then he receives the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments. And let's see. No. Exodus 20. He's up there. So being up there is also a symbol for, although it's a physical mountain, for a very high spiritual experience. There's a number of religions, prophet or sage or mystic, whatever, had his experience on a mountaintop. Muhammad did on Mount Hira. He had this revelation on Mount Hira. So here on the mountain, God spoke these words to Moses, and I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of bondage, out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the end of the polytheism. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. So he received that. And then meanwhile, on the bottom, in the 40 days, the people were getting pretty assumed the Moses probably had died by then, and they had Aaron fashion a golden calf, which some of them worshipped. And when Moses came down, he was infuriated by this, God was infuriated by this, and this was a symbol of the sin of idolatry. And it doesn't have to be so literal as to worship a golden calf. I think in our modern Western society, we have many forms of idolatry that take place. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Money.
Cars.
Prestige. Power.
Power. Okay. Money. That's a god, Mammon. Jesus said you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and Mammon. So money is a big master for many people. Power, there was a god for that, Moloch. So society is based on money, purely that, and pure capitalism would be profit, money. pure communism or fascism would be pure power and so forth. These would be idols of our time. And there's another idol that's very sneaky kind of idol that's sort of taken over almost all over. And what is that?
New Age.
Well,
Pleasure?
No.
Well, those could be idols, but what do some people who do not believe in God believe in?
Self.
Self.
Well, yeah, could be, okay, self. Believe in self, only self. That would be cool. Maybe humanism or something. Humanism. But we have any other thoughts?
Atheism, no belief at all.
In some ways, are not this scientists becoming the new priests, and some of them are men of, or women of God and so forth, and science is just a part of the creation and the way of studying nature. But to some, that is the whole that is the highest form of knowledge. There is no God. There's no spirituality beyond that. Everything is revealed by science, and I think that produces a kind of technology, and we in the earlier 20th century were very enthusiastic about technology. Now technology in some ways pushed having a very negative effects on on our planet. Any comment on that? Some forms of philosophy. Science per se, by the way, or any of these, money per se, or power per se, any of these things as a sort of apart things, the things that exist, there's nothing wrong with them, they're fine, they're parts of the creation. But if they become the ultimate value, then they become a god, they become a idolatry, and that seems to lead to disastrous results.
I think, when you were talking about science becoming a god, as an ex-pure scientist before I started doing applied science, I think that's another form of self-worship.
Yeah.
The idea that my knowledge is the highest goal. I don't think that it is worship of a thing or the principles of science. I think it's a devious worship of the human mind.
Yeah, that's good. That's kind of original. I haven't heard that anybody else say that. Okay, that the products of the human mind at a given time can know everything. Carl Sagan, self-professed atheist and humanist, that's one form of religion, actually. That's his highest value, and he goes through the history of science and all. And yet some of the most advanced scientists, the quantum physicists, among them are some very spiritual men and women who kind of are seeing science sort of at its limits and seeing that the worldview that must be so for even the facts of quantum physics to be so is not kind of a materialistic billiard ball kind of atomistic world at all, but I was reading a book, Henry Morgenau, who's a physicist, called The Mystery of Existence, and he comes to the idea of a universal mind, and that's kind of approaching God through science, a kind of a humble version of science. You see, science or any of these things are good and valuable in of themselves as sort of parts of the creation. But when the part becomes the whole, then that's the trouble.
How about the exploration of stellar space?
There's nothing wrong with that. This
yeah, but it sort of has the connotation a little bit of the Tower of Babel, trying to find God, and trying to find higher forms of life or other life, and eventually find out how the universe was created, and that's all part of that.
I think it has to do, though, with the purpose for which it's done.
Yeah.
I would gather that the Sears Tower in Chicago is probably taller than the Tower of Babel ever got to be. But there's nothing wrong with the Sears Tower. But the reason, the difference was that the people that created the Tower of Babel were placing themselves in the position of God by doing so, whereas there's no such intent. It's not the building of a ziggurat, it's what that ziggurat represented that was the sin of the Tower of Babel. And I think that's one of the issues that has scientists in two camps. The camp that says, I can know it all and then I don't need God, versus when I learn this, I know more about God.
Don't you think that one of the purposes of interstellar exploration is to find the source of the universe? And
Well, I heard an interesting lecture by Father Sean O'Leary, a Catholic priest who does scientific research on the effects of prayer, and he said he's criticized from the fundamentalist Christians, how dare you study prayer and the effects of God and so on, and from fundamentalist scientists who make fun of something like that. And he said that he feels that God gave us minds that are capable of thinking, capable of science, philosophy, and we are meant to use them to study nature and to study what our world is like. There should be no limit of that. If you don't confuse this objects of scientific study with God, who is not who's not an object of study in that way. Atheists, materialists, and all the Marxists said, well, we went out into space, we didn't see any God out there, we don't see, there are books coming out all the time of scientists sort of on one side or the other of the God debate. And some of the things said are pretty silly. It was physicist who said, in all my studies, I've never encountered a God. Naturally, God is not an object that you would find out there. He's from the...
Not like the Wizard of Oz. He's
you can pull the curtain.
Yeah.
You have that curtain. He's the subject of the whole curtain.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the
so I think... the two greatest contributions of Judaism is the pure monotheism. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, monotheism, and the injunction against idolatry. And that, I'm just repeating something that a philosophy professor, whom I had long ago, his name is Hiram McClendon, said, he was visiting professor from Harvard to NYU, and he said those things, that the greatest contributions, and he wasn't Jewish, he was Catholic, but the greatest contributions of Judaism are the monotheism, pure monotheism, and not dualism. There's no dualism in the pure Judaism, by the way. That crept into Christianity later. The injunction against idolatry, and they symbolized so powerfully and beautifully in the burning bush episode, and in the golden calf, and
But what do you mean by the dualism in Christianity? The fact that Christ was the human and divine?
No.
The good.
I mean the idea.
The good and the bad, the evil.
No. Somehow of God and universe being totally separate, whereas in Judaism, let me give you a little thing I said yesterday, there is the kind of the Great Spirit, and that's Shaddai, and then there's the creation, and in Judaism the creation is sacred, and it is imbued with the female aspect of the deity, which is the Shekinah. It has the word she in front, and that's just an accident. In Hebrew, Shekinah, and that's the creation. Is not somehow, I get the feeling that lots of Christianity forgets about the sacredness of creation, and you have exploitation of our Mother Earth, and you know, the Native American tradition very much holds with the sacredness of
Mother Earth, the creation. Father Sky.
Father Great Spirit, Great Wakantanka, and Mother Earth. So the material creation is not a thing to be exploited. That is imbued with the Shekinah, which is the feminine presence of God, and then the Great Spirit is sort of thought of in more masculine terms, but those two are ultimately one. The oneness is complete there. It isn't God apart from the world, but the God who is infinite, but then who is completely, what would be the word, good word, you have an English degree from Harvard, but...
The immanence.
Right. Thank you, Jeff. The immanence of God in the creation is the Shekinah, and of course we're usually not aware of that, and that would produce a whole history of Western European exploitation of the nature and creation. So. Nature is sacred too, and that's so.
Thank you.
I wasn't speaking about Martin Luther King of all the time.
I had written one sort of family history, not family history, but sort of like a
Oh,
you want to, have you read it?
Yeah, I read it. Oh,
you want to bet?
Yeah.
So you were Judaism too?
Yeah,
for 7 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was raised by a Jewish father.
Oh, really?
For 7 years.
No.
And we just